All right. Okay. I've been a bit generous, but we might have to run at the end. Okay. So, everything I just talked about was to do with the first part of the speech chain, and now, surprise, surprise, we're going to be looking at the second part of the speech chain, what happens when the signal arrives at the ear of a listener. Okay, so just like this didn't evolve for speaking, your ear didn't evolve for speech, for listening to speech, your ear evolved because, like many other animals, having a sensor which senses what's going on in the acoustic environment is incredibly useful. So a predator steps on a twig within your hearing, you not only know what's happened, but you might even know which direction to run to get away. Okay? Really rather important. So acoustic sensing, sound localization, and also for communication. Many animals use the sounds and use voices to communicate. It's just that none of them seem to have something as complex as human language, which we were just talking about down here. Okay, so the ear is rather general purpose, and basically what it's doing is not at all surprising. It's doing a kind of frequency analysis. The ear is basically trying to figure out what energy there is at different frequencies, and that's the nature of the perception. What you hear then, from arbitrary sounds, not just speech, but any sounds, what you tend to hear is, if there's anything that's repeating, if it's repetitive at all, you will hear a pitch. So the pitch is related to the repetitions that occur in a signal. So it could be a creaking of a door, you might hear a pitch. Okay? The loudness, of course, how loud the sound is, you're sensitive to that. And the timbre, which is this word which is just covering all the sort of shapes and sizes and colours of sound that might occur in the environment. Okay, so a little bit of anatomy again. So this is slicing through the human ear, and it's it's a very, very complex structure. But we typically divide it into three. First of all, there's the outer ear, which is the bit we can see, this bit here, and the tube which runs down into the eardrum, which then separates the outer ear from what's called the middle ear. The middle ear contains the smallest bones in the human body. We'll look at this in a moment. And then that leads into what's called the inner ear. So basically, this complex structure is designed, or that's a very bad word, has evolved, to take information or energy that is occurring acoustically, in other words, in vibrations in the air, and it's to transfer that energy into neural signals. That's what this is all doing. The reason it's a complex structure is you can't easily do that in one go. So it actually, the human ear converts the acoustic energy in air into energy which is in a liquid medium, and then the energy in the liquid is transformed into neural energy. So it's a kind of two-stage process. Anyway, let's go through it all. So this is the outer ear. This what we all call the ear here. This is the pinna. And you might wonder why everybody's got this rather weird shaped thing, and for a while people just thought that there was no significance. But it turns out that actually the shapes in your ear have a very big effect on your ability to localize sound in the vertical domain, which is very, very interesting. Because if you think about it, you've got your two ears, you can make a judgment about where sounds are horizontally. But how do you tell whether something is behind you or in front or high or low? And it turns out that all these shapes, they're all different in different people, but you, when you grew up, you know, as a child, learnt the relationship between the azimuth, the vertical orientation of sound, and the consequences for the sound in your auditory system as shaped by all these weird lumps and bumps. So it's not just a random shape, it actually serves an interesting purpose. So, the meatus, the tube, that's about almost 3 centimetres long. This is in adult male, of course, typically. And what you've got at the end is the eardrum, and the eardrum is essentially the first transduction, but it's also blocking everything off. That is sealing the rather sensitive apparatus that's on the inside from the outside world, which means you can go swimming and you can get things in your ears, an insect can go in without doing horrendous damage to your hearing. Okay? So, basically the sound waves go in and they cause the eardrum to vibrate. Very, very straightforward. So this is what, so that was the outer ear. Now the middle ear, as I say, has some of the smallest bones in the human body. There are three bones here, and this is now a very interesting mechanical transduction, where it's taking rather low torque energy and converting it to a high torque energy. And that's not explaining that very well. But basically, these three bones that you can see here, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes, are levers. And they're mechanical levers, so vibrating the eardrum causes, you know, there's quite a lot of movement at the eardrum, that is, but at low pressure, and whereas at the other end of these three levers, you've got very little movement, but at high pressure. And that is going to transmit the sound into the next stage, which is liquid. Okay? Right, so I think I probably said a lot of this. So those three bones are called the ossicles. We get 35 times pressure because of this lever arrangement, which means we can hear things like 1,000 times quieter than we would otherwise without that arrangement. It's a really neat solution. The other thing which is on the bottom there, which you've probably just read, is it's also a protection mechanism. There are muscles acting on those levers, which if there's an incredibly loud sound, so either if you're near an explosion or a rock concert or whatever you do, something really, really loud, you probably noticed afterwards, if you've experienced that, afterwards, everything's a bit muffled. And that's because these muscles have said, that's too much, I'm going to do damage. And they pull these bones apart and basically create a much, the path for the sound now is reduced to basically minimize damage to the inner ear and the auditory system. Those muscles are not great, and if you persist... in attending high noise environments, or you've got your iPod in playing very, very loud over a long period of time, you will do damage to those muscles, which will do damage to your hearing system, which means that in older age you will have severe hearing loss. So please be careful about that. Your ears are very sensitive. Okay, so the stapes, which is the third of the three levers, is sitting there on the top left. And that's connecting to this weird snail-shaped structure, which is the cochlea. I'm sure you've all heard that word. And this contains this tube, which is it would be nice if it was a long tube, but there's not enough room in the ear for that, so it's basically just wound round for space. But it's filled with liquid. So these three levers take the energy in the air and are now transmitting this through a window at the end of the tube and basically pressing against that, transmitting the energy into this liquid. And inside this tube and embedded in the liquid are all the neural transducers, little fibers, little neurons, hair cells, you probably heard that as well. They're sitting inside this liquid. So as the liquid vibrates, so the hair cells vibrate, and that, of course, is sending that electrical information up into the brain. Okay, so again, I probably said most of this. I think I've said all that. Actually, the tube is not a simple tube. There's a membrane, or in fact, two membranes down the middle of it, and effectively, when there's a pressure wave which hits that window, that pressure wave travels down, comes back, and there's another window at the bottom, so they're sort of operating like that. The other consequence of it being liquid in a tube, from last week and from the last lecture, you know tubes have properties. Tubes have very interesting properties. They have resonances. And one of the properties of these tubes, these little tubes, is the resonances of the tube cause different frequencies to have high energy at different places along the tube, or in this case, along the cochlea. So this is how the frequency analysis is performed. Okay, so if we unroll it, it looks a bit like this. By the way, these structures are very similar to our balance mechanisms, and it's quite conceivable that, from an evolutionary point of view, that hearing has evolved out of balance, because of the similar kinds of structures with neural sensors inside liquids which are slopping around in the case of your vestibular canals. Okay, so there's sort of a relationship here, which is why, by the way, some diseases of hearing, like Meniere's disease, you have also have severe balance problems. It's called a connected system. Okay, so now this is slicing through the tube. It's a very complex structure, but all you need to know is that we've basically got a liquid-filled tube here, and we've got neural sensors embedded all the way along. Right, so the energy comes in, there's resonances, we get what are called standing waves or travelling waves, and that leads to peaking energy at particular positions, and those positions correspond to the frequency of the sounds that are coming in. Which basically means if we have a sound coming in with many different... sound coming in with energy at many different frequencies, that means that there will be peaks of activity at different points along the basilar membrane. Okay. So basically, this is essentially acting like a whole bank of bandpass filters. So a bandpass filter, we'll be going into filters in a lot more detail later, but for now, a bandpass filter is just a device which is sensitive to energy at a particular frequency, but not at a lower frequency and not at a higher frequency. So if you have a bank of those all set up for different frequencies, that's basically a good approximation to what seems to be going on inside the human, the inner ear. All right, so that's a lot of words. Let me just show you a short animation here which might make some of what I've said a little bit clearer. So that was from the outer ear, zooming through to the inner ear, unrolling it, and now we're going to have some sound. Low frequencies at the far end. So, I hope you can sort of get the basic idea there. It unraveled the cochlea, and basically what we're seeing is that high frequency sounds, the energy tends to concentrate quite close to the oval window. So near the entrance, whereas low frequency sounds tend to concentrate at the far end, right down the other way. So basically it's a decomposition. It's taking a waveform which has energy at many different frequencies, all kind of all meshed up together, and laying it out on a frequency axis. So we can, of course, I mentioned it was we can model it using a bank of bandpass filters. So here's a PD version of exactly that. So we should see, now this is a, look at all this. So here is a whole load of filters in PD. I'm not going to spend too much time looking at that. And over here we've got the simulation of the basilar membrane. And if I switch on a tone, so we've got the waveform at the top, the so the high frequencies So basically, this is laid out. We've got a bunch of bandpass filters simulating actions different down the cochlea. We've got a tone which is sort of mid-range. If I change the frequency of the tone, make it higher, it will go up. So you see different filters are resonating. Notice I do use the word resonate here with a filter. So filters resonate, which is why, by the way, formants can be regarded as a filter. Now, set that at 1,000. Now let's have the other one in, another tone. So we've got a very complex waveform, right? So how would you know from that waveform that there are two tones present? You have to do a frequency analysis. And that's exactly what this simulation of the cochlea is doing. Because we can see that we've got one tone resonating up here and another tone resonating down there. Okay, so the simulation of the basilar membrane has separated two tones which are in the waveform leading to this sort of complex shape. So it's a way of doing frequency analysis. Very, very straightforward. Nothing brilliantly exciting there. But just proves the point. And we can do that with PD. Right. So now, what I'm going to do now, this idea of looking at speech as... start again. The idea that doing a frequency analysis is valuable is a very interesting way and a valuable way of studying what a speech signal contains from an information point of view. So you heard about the waveform and I talked about the spectrum, but if we take the spectrum, which is a frequency analysis, and we repeat that over time, we get something which is called a spectrogram. So the spectrogram is a time frequency, and then the darkness of the display is the amplitude of a signal. So I've got a real-time spectrogram program here. So this is essentially modeling, in some sense, approximation to what the human ear is doing. And it's a standalone program, which exists here somewhere. Where's it gone? Okay. Now, this sometimes crashes my Mac, so fingers crossed, everybody. It's a PC program which is going to try and attempt to run natively on the. Right. We may be lucky. Okay, I was expecting to see something. It still might happen. Sometimes it takes a while to get going. No, nothing. Okay. I don't know why. All right, so let me, just to orient you, this is time, frequency and amplitude. So if I stop speaking, there's nothing. If I whistle, okay. Get the idea? But what we're really interested in is what's happening while I'm speaking. So you can see all kinds of amazing patterns now. And if I just make some simple sounds, ow, and then if I just keep talking, you see all those things all going on at the same time. And this is spectrographic representation is a very typical way of studying speech. Now, if I stop this, so we can actually pause it, right. We can look at some static structure here. Is it big enough? Can you make it out? Just about. What I just want to draw your attention to, remember this is time, frequency. This noisy looking stuff, that's an S, that's a S, right? That's frication. These bands, which you can see here, those are resonances, which have the special name, which is formants. and if you look closely, I don't know if you can see this on the back, do you notice there's a lot of vertical lines here? Can you see those vertical lines? Every single vertical line is a slap of the vocal cords. So basically what you're seeing in this analysis, and this is very much the kind of thing that the ear is doing, it's seeing the information as it's The energy is going into the system that illuminates, every puff of energy illuminates the resonant structure, and we see that in this kind of analysis. Now, if I change a parameter here, what you've just seen is known as a wideband analysis. That will be explained in a subsequent lecture. For now, all you need to know is that it has very fine time resolution. And that's why we can see the individual coming together of the vocal cords. Very good time resolution, but rather poor frequency resolution. If I change from wideband to narrowband analysis, by clicking on that, and off we go again. So I'm hoping this will work. I don't know why it takes... Oh, there we go. Yeah, so now we've got some speech going through, and again, I will pause it so we can have a look. Now, all I've done now is change it from fine time resolution and poor frequency resolution to poor time resolution and fine frequency resolution. And you'll see the picture, still speech, very similar, but what you now see is you can't see the vertical lines. Because it's poor time resolution, we can't see when the individual vocal cords are coming together anymore. You also notice the formats have gone. What we're now seeing are all these harmonics. All those harmonics, that's the harmonics of the pitch. Because now we've got fine frequency resolution. So whereas before we could see the individual timing, now we're seeing the actual harmonics. Now this, in signal processing, is a crucial dilemma. Do we want fine time resolution and poor frequency resolution, or do we want excellent time resolution? Did I say the same thing? Yes. Or poor time resolution and excellent frequency resolution. This is a trade-off that everybody has to make in signal processing. We'll talk about that again when we come to signal processing, but for now this is important because I've just shown you two ways of looking at speech. Right? So the question is, what's the ear doing? So, now this is where we might lose everything. Maybe I won't stop it. That's probably the safest thing to do. So I'm just going to repeat what I've just said with some examples. So this is a wideband speech spectrogram. Now it's very clear, you can see the format, resonances, the resonances of the vocal tract, and you can see these vertical striations, those are the individual coming together of the vocal cords, putting energy into the system. A wideband analysis, good time resolution, poor frequency resolution. As opposed to this, it's the same signal, but now we've got good frequency resolution, poor time resolution, and we're seeing harmonics of the pitch, and everything else is kind of smeared in time. So this is a narrowband speech program. Now, depending on what you're studying, you would choose one or the other or somewhere else. But this is a decision that has to be made in all speech processing, whether you're building, you know, just a simple analyzer or if you're building a speech recognizer, you need to think about exactly what you want here. So there they are side by side. Now, one thing where people often get this wrong is they think that the scales are different. Note, we've got both on the screen, both have the same frequency scale, which is from 0 to 5 kilohertz. We're not changing the scale, we're changing the resolution of the analysis and balancing time versus frequency analysis, not changing the scales. Okay? It's just different frequency selectivities. Now, why am I boring you with this? It's because the auditory system seems to have evolved to do the best of both worlds. It has excellent temporal resolution at high frequencies and excellent frequency resolution at low frequencies. Because the ear is not constrained, you know, to be like a digital processor, you have to make this choice. The ear can do what it likes. It can't overcome the compromise, but it can do different things at different frequencies. And that seems to be what the auditory system is doing, which is really rather interesting. So a spectrogram on the top there is a wideband spectrogram of the type we were looking at before, but the cochleogram, that's the term used for a spectrogram-like thing which is generated from a model of the cochlea, looks like what we have at the bottom. We've got good frequency selectivity at the low frequencies, good timing selectivity at the high frequencies, and you'll also notice the scale is different. It is more of a logarithmic scale. So what we use for as instrumentation, like a straight spectrogram, just using some signal processing, is, you know, is not a brilliant model of the rather clever stuff that seems to be going on inside here. Okay, I think I've said all of that. There we go. So obviously all this information is in the slides. Right, why have we got two ears? I mean, I guess if you lose one, that would be useful. You've still got one to go with. But why have you got two? Yeah, I actually said it earlier. It allows you to determine where the sound is coming from. That's very hard to do with one ear, although, as I said, the shape here helps you a bit, but it's significantly more difficult if you've only got one sensor to figure out directionality. If you've got two sensors, you can do a lot. So there's a whole area of research called auditory scene analysis. In fact, there's a book here called Computational Auditory Scene Analysis, and if you can make it out, which you probably can't, but our head of department is one of the authors on this book. That's his area of speciality, Computational Auditory Scene Analysis, or CASA. So binaural auditory processing allows us to localize sounds, which means we maybe then can direct our eyes. We know where to look to see where a sound is coming from. So how do we do that? Well, there seem to be two mechanisms. One is that if a sound is coming from over here, it's going to reach this ear before it reaches this ear. And so there's going to be a timing difference. But also, if a sound is coming from over here, it's going to be louder in this ear than this ear. And lots of people have studied both of these mechanisms, and they both seem to be functioning. And the interest these days is in having not just two microphones. I mean, most, you know, Siri has one microphone. Alexa, on a dot, has seven microphones. And it's, you know, with technologically, we can go beyond the human hearing in principle, right? We could instrument an entire room with many, many sensors. But then we have to make sense of all the information that's coming in on all those different sensors. So, oh, very interesting area of work. Okay, so now what about the brain? Well, you'll be relieved to know I'm not going to say much about this, mainly because we don't know much about this. We know a lot about the structures, but what's going on, we really don't know. There's a lot of names. Do not remember these. You're not expecting you to remember these. I'm just pointing out that there is not a simple... Once we've got the signal transduced into neural form, it's not just a straight, simple pathway straight up into auditory cortex. There's lots of stuff going on, including some cross connections, which are probably to do with measuring interaural time differences and something like that. Very complex structures. Plenty of people working on this. Not a lot of knowledge about exactly what's going on. Still a very big research area. Okay, but what people have studied in some depth is, for example, what can people hear? What can you tell? Can you tell the difference between one sound and another very similar sound? And this is all called auditory psychophysics. So, how, you know, what's the quietest thing you can hear? What if you have two tones? How far apart can they be before you realise there's two rather than one tone? Things like that. All in auditory psychophysics. This is a classic measurement of, this is an audiogram, so if you did have a problem with your hearing and you went to the doctor, they would do an audiogram, which would basically mean you listen to some tones and you press a button to say you can hear it, and that will indicate your sensitivity. And if this is a typical audiogram, basically shows that we're very sensitive, human hearing, very sensitive to sounds, in the roughly the 2000 frequency region. So low is good here. Okay? So we're not so good at high frequency, which is the right-hand side, and we're not so good at low frequencies, so there's a certain range of frequencies that we're capable of hearing. You guys will be capable of hearing much higher frequencies than I can at my age. With age, that right-hand side starts to come down. But basically, 2,000 hertz to 1,000 hertz is where you're most sensitive, and that is where the second formant sits, the second resonance in the vocal tract, which turns out to be the most informative part of the speech signal. So this is very convenient, probably not a coincidence, because these systems, of course, have evolved to work together. And so you are most sensitive in your hearing to the most informative part of a speech signal, which is what you'd hope would be the case. If you were designing this, that's what you'd do. That's how it is. Okay, so, yes, a bit more about frequency selectivity. So the typical range, 20 hertz to 20K, although mine's probably down to 15 or less now. Our ability to discriminate sounds varies. So at low frequency, we can distinguish very close tones, but at high frequencies, they have to be a much further apart to distinguish them, all kind of predictable. We also have a situation where certain sounds at one frequency can mask whether you hear a sound at an adjacent frequency. This is because of the auditory filters. So the auditory filters, these are what's going on inside the cochlea. I can't remember, I used to have a graph. Let me just check if this is coming. Otherwise, yes, it's coming, right. So I don't need to wave my hands around. So I'll show you the shape of the auditory filter in a minute. And it's a typical signal processing filter would be a lovely, you know, symmetric shape with a peak at one frequency, like a resonance. But auditory filters, again, are not like that. Auditory filters are kind of offset in an interesting way, which is very nice. It also gives them good frequency selectivity and good timing selectivity, all within the one process. But the consequence of that is that if you have a tone at one frequency, it can mask a tone at another frequency, which sounds like a bad thing. But because we know that happens, we can design coding systems for music in particular, where we can throw away a lot of information from the signal because we know it's not heard. And so you might be interested to know that that's exactly what MP3 coding is. MP3 coding... and I met the designer actually one time, he's a really impressive guy, basically is using this kind of perceptual knowledge to dispose of data but retaining full quality. That's why with MP3 you get a lot of compression, so not taking up a lot of room on your whatever storage medium you're using, and that's because it's disposing of information in an intelligent way using this kind of knowledge directly from auditory psychophysics. Okay, I think I've probably said most of that. I've mentioned these filters, so here are one of the filters. Normally in signal processing we would draw a filter that way up, but in auditory, in audiograms and auditory filters are always drawn the other way up. So what we've got here are some very sharp filters. What that means is that the filters in your cochlea are very selective. They respond to particular frequencies and not to frequencies that are close by, but it's also slightly asymmetric, which gives this very nice time frequency trade-off property. Okay, so I'm just trying to link. Just like some people can't speak, there are some people, unfortunately, who have hearing issues, problems with their auditory apparatus, and so that's what goes on then when we don't have the ability to hear. Right, okay, couldn't remember what's coming next. So what I'm going to show you now, again in PD, is a simulation of hearing loss. I don't know if anybody in this room has got hearing loss, but you've probably many of you will have elderly relatives who have significant hearing loss, and you may not appreciate just what the consequences are of losing part of your hearing. Now, usually hearing loss is not all or nothing. It can be, but usually it is a gradual reduction of sensitivity to high frequency sounds, which gives a kind of classic muffling effect. So I've got a simulation of that here in PD. So we're going to hear some speech, and I'm going to then make that quite difficult. Then I'm going to put some hearing loss in, and you can hear the result. Then I'm going to take the hearing loss away again, but I'm now then going to put the speech in a difficult environment with some music and some noise in the background, and then we'll do it again. See what happens. Here we go.
Murder most foul it is. Murder most foul it is, and I declare it.
So now put some hearing loss in.
Murder most foul it is. Eerie I find it. I feel the prickly heat, blood cold behind it. And without language is blooming hair.
So it's muffled. It's a bit quieter. You can probably make it out. Right, if you work hard. So this is what it is to have a high frequency, severe high frequency hearing loss. Now let's bring it back. But now I'm going to do the same thing, but we're going to put some noise in. Some music. Now. That's with normal hearing. Now let's add some hearing loss. Just catch it. Anyway, the point is clear, right? Which is, if you have an elderly relative with a severe hearing loss, do not talk to them in a noisy environment. Make sure it's a clean environment, because the effects are devastating. Even if it's a moderate loss, putting that into a noisy environment is terrible, which is why a lot of deaf people, by the way, campaign for the TV and radio programs not to have nasty jingles playing while somebody's reading the news or something like that, because it just makes it impossible for them to follow what's going on. Okay, campaigning over. What's next? I think we're nearly done, actually. Right, yeah, so, of course, there's technology for overcoming hearing loss. Just like we had the electrolarynx for people who have speaking problems, and hearing aids have evolved significantly from the early days, from simple tubes to the latest hearing aids, which are almost invisible, and indeed some people now are bypassing the auditory system completely and putting in cochlear implants. Oh, that is next, yeah. So I don't know if you've heard about this, but for people who have sensory motor loss, where basically the system isn't working at all, the only thing you can do is put an electrode inside the cochlea to stimulate the neural system directly. This is known as a cochlear implant. So if you see somebody, in fact I was in a lift only the other day, and somebody who had two of these, one each side, if you see something like that, that is a cochlear implant. And basically the external part, there's an amplifier, and the external part is just talking sort of induction loop through to the inside part. And the inside part has an electrode, as you can see here, which is pushed into the cochlea. Now, it's a solution, but it's not a brilliant solution. I think I might have a recording. Oh, yeah. No, okay. Yes, I'm going to play. The consequences of, if you have complete hearing loss, then having any hearing at all, even if it's very poor, can have an incredible effect. Because, obviously, you appreciate people can lip read. A lot of people learn to lip read if they're deaf. So there's a lot of information on the lips. But just adding a little bit of auditory information to the lips can have a huge effect on intelligibility. Anyway, what's coming up is a video of a kid, a young kid who's born without hearing, and you're going to see the kid's cochlear implant being switched on. Oh, okay. Right, okay, I forgot. So the first thing you're going to hear is what it actually sounds like through a cochlear implant. This is a simulation of watch it. So you're not putting high fidelity signals into somebody's cochlea. It's a very crude, I think there's only like 16 positions that are used. And it sounds a bit like horrible whispered speech. So that's what you're hearing. This is a simulation of what cochlear implant speech sounds like. Try again. So it's pretty hard to, you probably only got a couple of words there. So it's pretty hard. But with lip reading and in context, that can really help. Anyway, this is the video. So this kid has had the cochlear implant inserted, and you're just about to see it switched on.
Here we go, it's coming back on, and he's back on again. See how he turns?
Hi, Jonathan.
Stop the sucking.
Hi. Good. Hi, sweetie. Could you hear that?
So, really rather important piece of technology there, which involves speech processing. So, making a big difference to some people's lives. All right, so just to finish off then on this one, if you cannot hear, that's one thing, but it means you can't follow what other people are saying. But there's another impact, which is you can't hear yourself. And if you can't hear yourself, you don't know what noises you're making. You can't control your own speech production. So again, if you know anybody who has some severe hearing loss, you probably also recognise that they have slightly strange pronunciation. And that's because they're not getting the feedback. They don't know what they're saying. They can't hear what they're saying. And it's vital. So when you are speaking, you're not just doing all those athletic movements of the tongue and everything I was talking about, but you're also attending to the consequences and making very careful adjustments to your motor planning as you're speaking. Okay, so this is some what we call deaf speech. So people who have severe hearing loss saying a particular word, and the question is, can you recognise what the word is? Okay. So you probably can't. I'll just run it again. And now a normal person without hearing loss saying the same thing. So you can see that those pronunciations are way off, and that's because they can't hear what they're doing, so they only have a crude approximation to the behaviour. And so any kind of auditory aid would also help with their speaking. Okay, so that brings us perfectly to time. So what we've done is all through the hearing mechanism, binaural processing, what have you. So very good. And next time we're going to look more widely at what speech is like. See you next Tuesday.